Blog Talk Radio.
I've been holding on to a secret, the deep dark kind that you keep inside. All of my life I've been so mixed up, tried to run but I just can't hide. Every day when I look in the mirror, I can't believe all the faces I see. I feel stained and I feel dirty, but soap and water never washed me clean. No, this is not my imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you hear is a true confession of a deep, dark secret that's been haunting me. Sometimes it's too hard to remember. Over memory is killing me. How could someone say they love you and take away the child in me? Every day when I look in the mirror, I can't believe that it's happened to me. I've been hurt and I feel cheated. Finally set me free. No, this is not my imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you hear is a true confession of a deep, dark secret that's been haunting me. You have is a true confession that the deep dark secret, that the deep dark secret set you free, set you free.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is David Little Eagle, and I am your host for this show, Fire Talk, with my co-host and producer, Nell Pohl. Ladies and gentlemen, where do you go? Where do you go, and what can you say after all has been said and done? All the pain, all the grief, all the suffering, all the self-condemnation and condemnation coming from others, after all the abuse, after all the pain, after the mourning. Because in each case of abuse, there is a mourning because there is a loss. But I know, that in the world of the sacred, world of the spirits, there are new beginnings, like a butterfly emerging from a cocoon. On the show today, we have two very beautiful butterflies. And it is a great honor to introduce these two extraordinary women who are not just guests on this show. They are part of our family at Fire Talk. So with great pleasure, I introduce Patricia McKnight and Annie O'Sullivan. Welcome to the show, my sisters.
Hello. How is everyone? Blessings, everyone. So happy to be here with these such strong connections between everyone, and I'm so happy to be part of that. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's an honor to have you. Now, we're going to begin with you, Patricia. We're going to share a little bit of the experiences, but then we're going to take a different direction, and somewhere through the show, I'm going to be offering a prayer through a song for you, for Annie, and for all those out there who have experienced such horrible things in their lives, but yes, who are there, and Creator is going to touch them and heal them. That's my prayer. Love you, sister. And so we're going to begin with you. You're going to be reading something, so let us begin.
Thank you very much, Chief David Little. Yes, I am going to be reading. I have a lot of connections out there that we've been trading support and positive energy with, and I've heard a lot about being afraid to read my book, My Justice, because of the triggers that it might cause. So I thought what I would do for everyone today. I am going to read to you just probably about four paragraphs here from the very, very worst part of the book, the very, very worst part of my life, the part that I died, and I became no longer me. And this will be the most triggering part of the book. But you're safe. Anybody that's listening, you're safe. It's okay. You're not in that mess anymore. You've got your life, and there's so much more to live. So I'm going to take you into this right now. We're just going to read about four or five paragraphs of this real quick, because I want to walk you through the very worst of it together, and then maybe you'll be comfortable reading the book because you'll know you already got through the worst. Okay. He held the gun, pointing at my face, and then reached down to unzip his pants, his hand hurriedly digging through his boxers so that he could pull out his pants. At first, I hoped maybe it would just be a blowjob or something, and then he would let me go. But instead, he put my hand around him and gave the instructions for me to play with it like he had taught me. He grabbed my hand tighter, forcing me to squeeze harder around him. It was disgusting. I thought he would be happy and let me go. But that was not his intention. Before he could complete his enjoyment, he pulled my hand away, almost throwing it away from him. He ordered me to get up off the bed and to go stand in front of the bay window at the end of the bed. The next thing was to remove my clothing. As I stood there naked in front of the window, my head was swimming with questions and doubt. What if Richie comes upstairs? He could walk in and see me naked. I wondered if anybody was outside or possibly someone was looking through their window. Maybe they will look up and see the little girl standing naked in front of a huge bay window, looking out for someone to help her. My brother was friends with the boy across the street. Would he be looking out his window tonight? Would he notice me up here, standing naked, looking for a way out? Maybe someone would rush in the house and take us all away. Those were my wishes. Walter sat on the bed staring at me for a moment, as if he was looking and leering at a woman instead of the child that stood there. He said to me, "You really are starting to grow, aren't you?" Then he got up from the bed to walk over towards me, his ever-so-present evil grin showing on his face. As he came towards me, he was holding the shotgun, which he had pointed directly at me. My eyes followed his every move. He started to circle my breast with the point of the barrel. Then he slid it down my stomach and poked at my thigh. I looked up at him. The tears were so hard to hold back. I couldn't cry. I couldn't make a sound. That was part of the torture. When he reached my thigh, his gaze bolted, and he pushed me over to his bed. As a child of only 13, I cannot explain the terror I felt that night. But you have to overcome your fear in order to survive. You have the ability to go numb, so that you can protect yourself. This is a gift from God. He walked to the bed and stood over me. The cold barrel was now making a line on my stomach. I started to drift away again, going deep into my body, so I didn't have to feel his touch. Unfortunately, though, I could feel the cold of the steel against my skin. The gun was used to circle my breasts and trace down to my vagina. I wanted to scream. I don't know why I didn't. I think he must have sensed it, because he got directly in my face, and then I heard, "Don't you make a fucking sound. I will kill you." He spoke the words so matter-of-factly that I didn't dare make the slightest whimper. I just lay there, as I felt completely defenseless against him. I knew he would do as he said. I tried so hard just to sink into the mattress below me. "Please let me become part of it so that I am not here." Then I jolted when the barrel was pointing back up, but this time pushing against the bottom of my chin. I could feel the pressure start as he pushed it against me harder to reinforce what he had said. He moved the barrel slowly back down so he could circle my breast with it again, and then farther down to push the point of the barrel against my vagina. I was disappearing, fading away now, deeper and deeper. I went to escape the reality of what was happening to me. There was nothing I felt until the barrel was pushing against me. The barrel is inside me, and it hurts so badly. The pain is ripping me apart. Please, God, make him stop. It hurts. Please make him stop. The tears were rolling down the sides of my face. The pain was burning deep down inside of me. I could feel it tearing at the flesh. He wouldn't stop, though. He just kept going. My pain did not stop him. My tears did not stop him. No one came upstairs to stop him. I knew then that he would torture me for as long as he possibly could. I let out a slight groan of pain, but I really wanted to scream. His free hand reached up to cover my mouth, and just that quick, he pulled the gun out of me. Finally, he stopped, and I opened my eyes and stared at the ceiling, but I was not able to feel anything, not able to feel the pain or the tears, not even a feeling of being afraid. There was no feeling at all. I was gone. The quickness he used to withdraw the barrel of the gun increased the threshold, but to me, it brought an intense ending to his torture. It was rape. It was rape on the worst level. My virginity was now gone to the barrel of a shotgun. It was in that moment that he was able to destroy me. The little girl who had survived so much of his torture now buried herself and her feelings. The only part of her that would show for the next 30 years was the part that carried the shame of disgust of what happened. Everything was buried so deep that I could not share love or pure intimacy until after many years of therapy. That's the part that I felt was the very hardest part to write. It was the very hardest part to remember. It was the point that he, after that, there was no me, and I was afraid of nothing that anybody could do to me.
Wow. That was so courageous of you to read that to us, and we so appreciate it. There's many people in the chat room that can identify with what you said, and they're right here with you, sending you their love, as we are. I'm so proud of you.
Thank you. Now, before we continue, I need to make a disclaimer. Nobody on the show today is a professional therapist. We are not doctors. We are not trained counselors. But what we are is a family. And at this point, we are sharing. And, you know, we just want you to understand that in spite of everything that's happened, there is hope. And I think that we can find hope and strength in one another, and that's what we're here for right now. And Patricia, I want to reiterate my sister Nell's thanks. You are a very courageous and very beautiful lady, and I am so proud of you. So with that, let's continue.
Right. And there is one more thing I wanted to say, that even though the content is hard, this is a celebration in my mind of these two ladies coming out of pure hell, finding their voice, writing their story, and then having enough guts to come on the air and say it. So although it is very difficult content, it to me is complete celebration that they took back their life and their story and their voice, and they're out there swinging, trying to help others. So I'm so proud of both of you.
Oh,
that's exactly right. That is exactly right. That means so much now. And, you know, to be able, it is horrifying what happened. It is horrifying. And what we have to remember is the light at the end of the tunnel, because when it's over and we're adults and we're safe and we have control, we can gain back our lives, we can gain back our spirit, we can gain back what's been taken, and we can live our lives. And, you know, then we have to remember that we have to keep on fighting to help those that are still stuck there, that are still trapped, still being tortured.
Right.
And if we don't talk, nothing's ever going to end.
That's right.
Right. And
that's
sugarcoating it for comfort level doesn't help the people who survived this level of stuff identify, because
right.
it makes them feel like, well, mine's, you know, what I lived is nothing like everybody else is saying. So you need
correct.
To speak the truth so that people know she survived the same kind of thing I did, and she's made it, and so can I.
Correct.
Uh-huh. That's right. And, you know, this is not just for, the veteran warrior survivors. Because that's my term for them, and I'm honored that Nell and a number of extraordinary survivors have used the phrase warrior survivors, because survivors implies a victimology, but
right.
you, Patricia, and my other sister Annie, you women are absolute warriors. I am so proud. Now, you know, this is not just for those who experienced it in the past and are working to work past the pain and all that accompanied past events, but this is also for those who are experiencing these horrors at the present moment. There is help for you. There is help
yes.
for you. There are many watchers out there, and there are many people out there watching out for you. So if you're still experiencing these things, it's not just children, but you know you have young adults and adult women and even men who are experiencing terrors like this. We are here for you. So
absolutely.
Just to let you know, you're not alone.
And that is so important. So important.
Oh.
You know, David, I mean, it's just to reach out, and it's like giving a big group hug to these people and saying, it's okay, you're going to make it. You
yeah.
will get through this. You know, you have that spirit, and we did it, and you can too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Annie, would you like to read your piece?
Sure. I'm just about recovered from listening to Patricia.
Oh, I know. She did such a wonderful job.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry,
No, it was great.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here is Annie O'Sullivan. I call her my Annie Oakley. She's my hero. I love the sister. She is so awesome. Annie, the stage is yours right now, darling.
Okay. I would like to, give you a little bit of background on what I'm going to read. And I almost can't believe it's complete opposite end of what Patricia just read. And this is actually from part 3 of my book, which is coming out next month. And it's called Redemption. When my dad was dying, I had not talked to him in 10 years. I had completely cut him out of my life. And all of that stuff is in the book, but obviously I can't read you all of that explanation. But this is the day that I got off the airplane to go to the hospice to see him. And So I guess it's just this kind of titled Day One, and I'm just going to read it. That's okay?
Yes.
It's hard to say who arrived, me, the adult, or me, the child. I've been stewing for 24 hours. I've had very little sleep. I'm tired, and I'm feeling very weary. My sister-in-law is picking me up. I've never met or even seen a picture of her. I stand looking around thinking this is silly. I'm the last one sitting at the baggage claim. I had her caged and finally walk over to a little coffee kiosk. I find I'm surprised a few moments later when a small woman with a baby on her hip waves at me. I'm Stacy. You look so much like Brian that it must be you. I heard the page that you were here by the cafe. I laugh. I don't tell her that I'm not sure what my brother looks like. He doesn't know me, and I don't know what he has told her about me, so I'm not volunteering much. She hugs me quickly, and the baby, who looks remarkably like her mother, grabs my hair. A baby, I exclaim. I'm your auntie, I say to her. She's beautiful. I love her instantly. Well, do you want to go straight to the hospice or to the house first? I'm really sorry to meet you under these circumstances. She gives me a searching look. I haven't thought about what to do. I stand there speechless over this simple question. She looks at me for a minute. Let's get your bags, then we can get coffee and decide what to do. I'm grateful for the reprieve. At least someone has a plan, because despite my stewing, I don't. Oh, this smells marvelous. I tell her, explaining it's my first time in a Starbucks. I go on. They haven't descended on Alaska yet. We have Kaladi brothers. I order a large double something. Stacy laughs when I comment what I really need is a triple. We plan to go to the house, drop the bags, then go to the hospice. I feel like a little fighter, a little like a fighter who has waited their whole life for just this one single match. I discover I'm ready. It's a beautiful summer day here in Oregon. I have the car window open, and I tell Stacy this is great. We arrive at the hospital quickly after a very short drive. We walk through the double doors, down a maze of hallways. I'm surprised that no one stopped us as we walk through the facility. I begin to wonder if I can find my way back out when she suddenly stops. Here we are. I stand there for a moment that felt like an eternity. This is it. I will go through that double door and nothing will be the same. I will leave a winner or a loser. I will leave broken or whole. He can break me. Crazy things are in my head. Hi, Daddy. Hi, Daddy. Devil been in yet? Hi, Dad. Met God? Talked your way out of hell yet? Hi, Dad. I hear you called me a whore last week. Hi, Dad. Daddy, are you sorry? Daddy, do you love me? Daddy, please love me. Daddy, please see me. That's it. that's my section. Sorry.
Oh, wow. Oh, I just love you two ladies to death. Y'all have really been through so much, and you're just so strong and just trying your best to grab hold of life and fight daily. And you're also trying to build a network to help others, and while you're trying to pull yourself out of it as well. You're just amazing to me to watch.
That's the first time I've heard that out loud, Mel.
Oh, man, you were getting me. I was like, oh.
You just felt
it's
chills
so
on my
hard
whole
when
body.
You have to go back and be around your family when they don't accept your truth and they're busy rewriting your history and you have to stand among them as your abuser is dying or even alive and looking at you with that smug look like, you know, they don't believe you, they believe me. All those things that survivors have to live.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, and my dad in the end, and in the end, and I go through all of this in the book, but in the end, of all people, nobody came. Nobody. I can't believe that you could live to be 64 years old and no one came when he died. I went to see him to hell. But it's kind of sad to think that you could get to the end of your life and nobody's there.
Right. Although I can understand why nobody would be there for him.
Well, he deserved it.
Oh, my Lordy, did he deserve it.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you had that closure, even though, you know, you wish that it was a different father relationship. At least you had that moment to kind of put it all in perspective.
Well, you know, I am grateful for the law, the spiritual law of reciprocity. And yes, I used the big word, and I am very proud of my vocabulary. But what the law of reciprocity simply is what goes around comes around. And you see, as I listen to you, to my sisters here, Trisha and Annie, and I've heard the voices of many survivors over the years. What I see in you two extraordinary ladies and many others whose names I will not mention to protect their privacy, but I saw extraordinary people who, despite all the slime and grease on their hands, from all the nastiness, they did grab hold. And what I see in you and in so many others is such a strength and such a beauty of spirit. And I think that that's what we're segueing into, isn't it, now? See,
yes.
We just heard some of the most horrific details of very real and unfortunately then ignored crimes that were committed. But, you know, where do we go from here? What do you say? And I know that both of you are have your hands out, reaching out to other people. How do you get past this? How do you, I mean, holy cow. How do you do it, my darling ones? How do you do it? You are so awesome, you both. So tell us, how do you go on? What have you done?
Annie,
do you want to go first? I guess. it's not the same for everybody. For me, I had just decided that my life was so uncomfortable that anything had to be better than what I was going through. And the truth is, you know, I mean, I'm a big believer in counseling. I say that all the time. I don't think this is something anyone should go through alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually ended up in counseling kind of by accident. My kids were starting to act out, and so I put them in counseling. And started talking to their counselor, and turned out, you know, the kid's problem wasn't, the kid's problem was what I was doing. I was teaching them to live as if they had been abused. In their behaviors, they actually showed those kind of signs. And it was a conscious decision to do something. And a lot of hard work.
Yes.
Right.
Oh, yes. We've had on a number of shows an extraordinary guest. Well, she's not a guest anymore. She's also part of the Fire Talk family, Dr. Nadine Von Williams, who spoke about intergenerational PTSD. And,
yes.
And you know, what you're describing is such a thing. Let me ask you, is it a matter where you actually taught your children to fear, because there is such darkness and such evil out there. So they acted out on that information.
Possibly. And, you know, I remember, I think I was on that show, actually. It was not something, it wasn't something that I was doing on purpose. I guess I'd like to put that
right.
out there.
Right.
Cause nobody's
right.
doing that on purpose, but you inadvertently
mm-hmm.
teach, you know, how you survive in the world is how you teach your children to survive in the world.
Yeah.
You know, they pick up, yeah. they just pick up on things. And, I've actually, one of my daughters and I have had a lot of conversation about it. She actually ended up in therapy in her teens, and it was actually a concern that something had happened to her. And thank God nothing had happened, but I got a real lesson in we just subliminally teach our children, and they pick that up.
Right.
I agree. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they react to the energy we're putting out more than the words we're speaking.
Mm.
Yes, that's exactly it.
Mm.
So they can feel our fear and our anxiety and all those things that make you, you know, cross the street where certain people are coming or pull back or all those different nuances of just walking through everyday life that our
mm-hmm.
children learn. Without any of us consciously knowing that we're doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, Annie, you are an extraordinary woman. I could see you teaching self-defense, and I.
I have a black belt. I was a black belt instructor for a 5-year-old class. Matter of fact.
There you go.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, do I know my sister or do I not?
No, that's too funny. And you know what? That was the most empowering thing. I mean, it took me 5 years, a little over 5 years to earn that. But I encourage survivors to take some sort of self-defense class. It's very empowering.
Absolutely.
And
uh-huh.
You learn, you know, especially if you've been beaten. It took a long time working with my instructor that I did not just defensively throw my hands up. It was a big day, the day that they came at me, and they didn't do that.
Wow.
And to know that you can take care of yourself physically,
yep.
it's huge. It's very
yeah.
I
know I personally know a very, very beautiful lady who is probably one of the fiercest ladies I've ever known, and the only way I could probably challenge her in a dojo is by practicing run can do karate. So come at me, I can run. You know, so yes, I like that concept, Annie. And how about you, Tricia? Because you're another warrior, and you know, you've really come into my heart and made yourself right at home there, darling. You know, how about you? You know, what did you do to get past all that the trauma? I know you said that you I think you also went for years into therapy, or did it take a long time for you to get into therapy?
It took a very long time for me to get into therapy. There was actually, at 23, I had attempted suicide with a bunch of Valium and a bottle of Jose Cuervo. And I had my babies in the house, and I couldn't let it happen. I couldn't let them wake up and be out by themselves. So I had called a friend who kind of helped me through, and the next day she told my mom what I had done, and my mom came over and she slapped me in the face and told me I had no rights, and insisted that I get in to go talk to someone. So she takes me up to therapy, and you know, I was just so hurt, and because the extreme of what my stepfather did. It lasted. It never stopped. He was 24/7 from the time I was 5 till I left home at 17, and even then it was still a stalking situation. But there was so much built up inside of me, and I had never said a word. And all of this to me has been explained that this was normal. It was normal that I scrub the house every day and not have time for myself. It was normal that I deal with my stepfather every night as I was trying to get dinner on the table and take care of my sister and my brother. And, you know, all of this to me was just my normal. It was just my life. It's just the way that it was. You know, and in that meantime, I was rotting away inside and out. You know, as Nell shared the YouTube video that I made, showing my teeth and the horrible, horrible scars that used to be huge infected sores on my skin. So I was a very ugly person, and I felt ugly inside and out. So by the time I made it into therapy after I had tried to commit suicide, I sat down in the chair and everything just came spilling out of my mouth. And we were there for about an hour, and it was just supposed to be an evaluation, but I couldn't help it. I had so much, you know, and it just kept spilling out of my mouth. And we walked out of there, and my mother looked at me, and we were standing in the parking lot. And again, she reached over, and she slapped me upside the head really, really hard. I mean, it almost knocked me over. My mom's not a big person. She's a small woman, small Irish woman. She knocked me upside the head, and she told me that that was none of her business, that there was no reason for me to have to go in there and sit and tell her what had happened. So I shut up from that point forward, and the life I lived was just continued acceptance of what I'd been trained, because I didn't believe that I deserved anything better. I just felt that this was who I was, and this is how my life was going to be. So my kids were born in the middle of all of this, and they lived in this. And, you know, they saw me with their father, and they saw me with my second husband, and then with two boyfriends after that. And, you know, by this time, they're in their teens, and just before I left my second husband, I was going to the doctor to get my wounds taken care of from the beatings, because I had my collarbones broken. And I was at the doctor's office, and you know, he knew that I was a battered woman, and he suggested therapy for me, and I agreed. And I went over to the counseling office, and I thought, okay, fine, you know, I'll talk to him, and I'll be done, and it'll be over with. And I couldn't talk. Whenever I got in there, I couldn't breathe. The counselor actually had to grab hold of me and guide me through breathing. I couldn't even breathe. I was just frozen solid. Everything, you know, I was in my late 30s, mid-30s. I think I was like 36, 37. So all of this I now have reflected on my children. It had reflected on me, and it was a pattern that I had to learn how to break. I had to make that decision that I wasn't going to take this any longer. I was going to have a different life for myself and my children. And when I left my second husband, I was in counseling, and I had left there one day. I had left counseling one day, and I went out into the middle of the woods, and I started beating the crap out of a bunch of trees. And I'm standing there with this branch in one hand, and I've got a rock in the other hand, and I'm beating the shit out of these trees, and I'm screaming, and I'm cussing, and I'm yelling at my stepfather, and I'm just screaming, and I'm crying, and I broke down, and I'm waiting for the men in the little white jackets to come and get me, you know, and take me and lock me away, because I felt that lost and that abandoned. So I would say that the point for me was, when I took that very last beating and the police walked in when I was finally able to call 911, and the police walked in, and they told me that either one of us had to leave or both of us were going to jail. I picked up my stuff. I left. I went and freshened up for work. I went into work, and so all that day, all I could think about was, I can't go back, I can't go back, I can't go back, and that was my turning point. That was it for me. I took my power back then. I was never, ever again. And although it happened two other times that I had two other men come after me, I was able to fight back and get the law involved and get the protection in there that was needed. I wasn't going to have this in my children's lives anymore. And that was my point. I would say my late 30s at least.
Wow.
Yeah, it takes a long time to dig out of this whole thing. And usually it is your late 30s before you finally start stabilizing all the things that happen. But the problem is, during that time, generally your children are, you know, late teens or a little older. So then you have to look back and go, like, you know, I wish I was who I am now, raising my children.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my children are adults now. The relationship with my daughters and my son is very sporadic. We go for days where it's beautiful, and then we go for periods where it's very horrible. And, you know, their words can attack me just as much as what they used to see the other men attack me whenever they're angry.
Right.
You know, I did my best to protect them. I bought a home so that I could give them a safety. You know, I put up a pool so that we could have a place of family enjoyment. We did family dinners every night. I tried to be, once I left my second husband, I did try very, very hard, and I worked so hard at my job. And luckily, I had gone back and I had gotten my education so that I could get a job that I could support me and my children with, and buy a home and get a stable life going for us. But it took so much work. I mean, there were days where I just never thought I would make it through, and I wanted to give up, you know, talking to myself. And it was just amazing how, but it, even after all of that, I when I came back to Illinois in 2002 and I was back in my mother's home because of an illness, I had pulmonary embolism and I had, I ended up having to sell my house and moving back here and getting stable, and I thought, well, I'll come back to where I grew up at. So I came back here and I tried rebuilding my life, and the only place that I had to go to was my mother's house, which meant back into my stepfather's world. And, you know, for 2 weeks I was there, and it was just like I was that little kid all over again, and I couldn't control myself. I couldn't control my thoughts. I was popping Xanax like crazy. I couldn't sleep. My mom had fixed up a bedroom downstairs for me, and she actually used the same bedspread that I used to hide myself in every night. It was just horrifying. It just put me right back into that place.
So do you think accidental or on purpose that she did that?
You took the words right out of my mouth. You know what, and I'd like to interject. I would like to interject something at this point. As I'm listening to my sister, Tricia, I'm going to tell something to your moms and dads, okay?
Uh-huh.
If your child is experiencing such abuse at the hands of your spouse, if your child is suffering and you not only ignore it, but you literally are complicit in the crime, and you further punish that child, you are a criminal. And I hope you're listening, because you are a criminal, and you should be in prison for allowing your child, whether you're a mother or father, to allow
right.
your child to suffer this.
Absolutely. A matter of fact, it's worse for it to be a mother in a lot of ways because these, you know, they let these guys in, and I've watched different one of these books, and the mother completely sold these children out to deal with their hateful husbands where they didn't have to be the target of their aggression. They threw their daughters to the wolves, and with no remorse, no even acknowledgement that they're doing it, but they threw these girls to the wolf like it was nothing. And they watched
exactly.
that wolf circle their child, and they just turned their back and walked away, or even worse, got aggressive toward their child. What are you complaining about? Quit. You're always, you know,
right.
bitching about different things. Why don't you just, oh, it drives me insane, these mothers, man.
Yeah,
how can you
exactly.
do that? How can you see your child being circled by a predator and just be so indifferent to it? Just sit at the freaking coffee table and drink your coffee and just act so arrogant about the whole thing. Oh, Lord help anybody
oh, yeah.
if I ever see something like that.
Oh, yeah, right.
No.
You know what? There is a breed of eagle called the bearcut, and I've
yep.
seen photos of this magnificent creature. That's my relative, okay? Because I'm a little eagle. And this eagle is so big it can take down a wolf. And now that you're mentioning feeding the children to the wolves, I'm
mm-hmm.
a bear cut, baby. All right, you know I'm not gonna put up with anybody abusing a child or a woman. It just ain't gonna happen, you know.
Right.
So you know, watch out, baby. Now let me ask you a question, Tricia. When you were out in the woods and beating the shit out of the trees, how did you feel afterward? And there's a reason why I'm asking this.
How did I feel afterwards? I think that I felt empty because I had empty and abandoned. I felt like I had nothing. I had no one, and I had been used. And I have been, exactly like you said, just completely sacrificed over to him in order to, so that she didn't have to deal. You know, he was never cruel to my mother. He was never controlling with my mother. He worshipped the ground that my mother walked on. And my mother sat back and watched so many things. So to me, it was an acknowledgement to me that it was the very first time in my life that I started holding her responsible, because this has been, you know, this has been coming up in therapy, but it was the very first awakening to me that she was actually part of this, and that all this time I had been begging and hoping and, you know, struggling to get her approval and her acknowledgement of who I was and that I was a person and that I had accomplished so many wonderful things despite what they had done to me. And, you know, when I walked out of those woods and I got in my car and I lit up a cigarette and I sat there and I don't know if I could really explain how it felt. It was just a sense of power on one end that I was going to get through this and that I was going to be okay, but on the other end, it was a complete sense of, what do I have now? No, I have nothing, no one. I have me, and I've got to think that's what I possibly can with just me, because I still have my kids, and I have to change their world.
Right.
So that was my stronghold for absolutely everything that I've accomplished. It was my children. I was not going to let them be subjected and live with a mother that didn't love them, didn't care, didn't want them,
right.
didn't acknowledge. My kids were not going to know that. And that's why,
right.
you know, I wrote the book as a journal to my children, trying to explain to them who, you know, I'm so sorry, and this is who I am, and this is what happened, and, you know, this is who they created, but you, my children, helped me to create a whole other person, to grow, to blossom, to be strong, and just to, you know, they were my light. And I just can't imagine, you know, like you guys, you know, seeing a mom sacrifice her children to anything like
right.
that. It's just, you know, you want to rip them to shreds, especially being a survivor. You know, I mean, I just
Absolutely.
Want to literally rip people to shreds. It's like, you have no clue what we're doing. They don't care what the long-term effects are going to be for that child. They don't care.
Right.
All they worry about is the
right.
six sessions at that particular moment. And,
yes.
and that's it. And it's sick.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Annie, you experienced essentially the same thing that Tricia talked about. Your mother was not just indifferent, but added to your trauma, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to this day, my mother remarried, and I really like my stepdad, but and he treated me. I say treated, and you'll understand that in a minute. But he treated me like a real daughter. He was always really proud of any little thing I did, and he would always introduce me as his beautiful daughter. And come to find out, my mother took me aside and explained to me that that was her husband. And I have not talked. Well, it's been years and years. I'm not allowed to talk to him. So. My mother never got it.
All these years later, she
doesn't get it. I was just a threat to her.
Right. Well, there's something within the mind where they made y'all non-human. And because to sacrifice you, they pretty much just, you quit being a human being to them. And you see that manifest itself in many ways in society. Where they
Absolutely.
People become non-human, and therefore you're indifferent to what happens to them, and that's
right.
what I
right.
saw when with you two ladies is your mothers quit seeing you as their child anymore. You just became like almost like their adversary, like you're the one that's trying to cheat with their husband.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's like,
yeah.
are you
and,
insane?
And I was the scapegoat in my family.
Absolutely.
You know, it my fault. Everything was my fault. If they had a fight, it was my fault. If we ran out of water, because we had our own well. That things were just always my fault, and I made their life miserable. And from a very, very young age, I was told, you know, I was born and ruined their life.
Wow.
And a lot of times they'll create one child that becomes the center of all blame, and then the rest of them are treated. As regular as you can within that circumstance.
Yes.
But then
right.
that way they make it look like it's that child's fault. Look how the other children are fine. It's, this one is a bad one. That's the problem.
Exactly.
Which is insane.
That is
now,
true.
I'll never forget whenever there was a point, you know, my family was all coal miners, we lived in a coal mining town, and the union miners used to get together and hold a picnic every year, and it was just the union miners and their families. So you're talking, you know, 300 people.
Yeah.
My stepfather and my mother, my stepfather was on a committee this one year, and he was on the planning committee, and they decided to have a bathing beauty contest. For the coal miner's daughter. And myself at 13 and these three other 16, 17-year-old girls were, I mean, I didn't want to do this because I never saw anything attractive about myself. I hated myself. I was covered with sores. My teeth were black and rotten and black holes. And, you know, I was ugly. I was ugly inside and out. And as I wanted to fight this off, and I kept telling them, you know, I don't want to do this, I was forced and I was told that I didn't have a choice, that he was on the committee and that it didn't matter, that I didn't want to get up there and parade around in a bathing suit in front of 300 people
And who even does that? Like,
yeah, it was my job. Just like, you know, just like caring for my sister and putting dinner on the table and washing dishes and doing the canning and doing the cleaning and doing the laundry. This was all my job. This is, you know, my mother went to work and came home. My stepfather went to work and came home. Everybody else did their thing, but everything centered around me taking care of everyone. So as I graded through this horrible, horrible feeling of standing up there and being judged by everyone in a bikini and standing next to these, you know, developed, you know, 17-year-old girls, and here I am at 13, and I'm standing and I'm walking and I'm parading, and oh my God, you know, I just wanted, as soon as it was done, I ran in the bathroom and I'm throwing my clothes on and I ran outside and I sat underneath a tree and I just cried. I couldn't do anything but cry, and I shook, you know, but nobody cared. Nobody cared. Yeah.
And he knew that that was your weakness, and that he probably created that whole circumstance just to have you have to go through that. They love when you suffer.
Yeah.
You know,
are we able to extend for a little bit? Because there's something that I feel really necessary at this point.
Now, we've got it set for 2 hours, David, so we're good.
Oh, you know what? that works for me. But what I would like to do at this moment is to tell you, Annie, and to tell you, Tricia, and to tell you, my beautiful sister Nell, and to all of you listening to the show, regardless of what you've been through, regardless of the pain, regardless of the shame, and the perpetuation of abuse and the crimes perpetrated against you, you, Mitakwati, my relatives, you are the children of earth and sky. You are the children of the sacred. And I'd like to offer a song. I'd like to offer a prayer. Because, you know, there's still a lot of hurt there, and there's still a lot of pain. And I want my sisters here on the show to know I love each and every one of you. I love you very, very much, and I honor you and respect you. And I also honor everybody who's listening, everybody who's in the chat room. So I'd like to offer this song, because I feel it in my heart. It has to come out, or I just might die if I don't offer this prayer to you.
Please do. How beautiful.
So,
thank you.
So, all with love, this is for you. Thank you.
Man.
No, that just grabs your spirit, you know?
It does.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I'm very protective of survivor space, especially when people are telling their story. And there's very few male energy I'll let into things because I know that those can trigger women. But David just has such an amazing spirit when it comes to dealing with survivors and hearing their story and seeing their true spirit that he's just a blessing to have on these shows.
Well, feel him, my
he's
love.
A
thank
blessing.
You very
just,
much. Thank you.
He's so sweet and just such a blessing to connect with because even though we haven't shared much together, David, you and I have been able to have that connection, and we found out that we actually were close to each other. So I can't wait for the day that I can actually give you a hug and tell you how much I appreciate all of you.
Oh, right back at you, my sister. I would give you a hug and just thank you. Just thank you face to face for the beauty that you are and for the beautiful spirit you are, hon. Thank you.
I want in on that.
Okay.
Got it.
Well, go ahead.
Got it.
Actually, it's funny. I've heard from a lot of people. They think that I know the two of you really well, that we're like old friends for years.
Wow.
They're picking up something when they listen.
It's amazing how the kinship is just there.
Well, I'll tell you, Nell is like my I'm a little older than she is, but she's my elder sis that kicks my ass when I need it. And,
I appreciate her
so much.
That's what it takes sometimes.
Yes, it does.
I mean, David's illegal. That's hilarious. All right, ladies, what I'd like to do is have y'all answer a question for me, if you would. Because basically all your life, you've had somebody come after your spirit to try to break it. How did you keep your spirit through all of this and maintain and even come out such a powerful spirit on the other side?
I guess I'll go first.
Yeah.
No, go ahead. I'm speechless.
Yeah, exactly, Annie. Exactly. Wow. You know, I don't know what it was that got me through it. I know that everybody here together as a family, I know that we're all spiritual in a sense, and that, you know, God and Jesus it isn't necessarily, but I'm hoping that I can explain to you, and as a child, little girl, church was my everything, and this was destroyed throughout my life by my stepfather. But for whatever reason, I don't know, I'm sure that everybody is familiar with that country song about the child who hides behind the couch, and then whenever she's rescued, she sees a picture of Jesus, and she tells the lady that's with her, you know, I know him, he was with me there behind the couch, and he protected me. I always had that kind of a sense. That's one song that just brings chills and tears to my eyes every time I hear it. I had always been somebody's object, someone's possession. I never had thoughts of my own or felt that, you know, the thoughts that I had didn't matter to anyone. There was no one that I felt that actually cared whether I lived or died. It was just me. And, I mean, I'm talking a community that I lived in of 1,500 people that knew who to call if they saw me doing something wrong, but not the police, not the school system, not
the friends of the family, not anyone who saw me as I rotted away and being controlled, and how my stepfather took me to bars and trying to pimp me out, and everything that happened within the small community. Not one person ever reached out. And I always felt that I had to conquer this, even whenever my stepfather would go on his whiskey rampages and my brothers would be in the house, they would run off and they would leave me there to deal with him. They didn't care if I made it out. And there were times that were dangerous, almost deadly.
Very much so.
You know, I had to have something, and it had to have been a natural spirit for me that I wanted something better. I always knew that I could, when I got older and I got away, I knew that I would have something different. I knew that whenever I became a mom, that I would be better than what was being given to me.
Right.
And I just had this determination. It was just a self. I was going to make myself a better person than what they had created, because the person that they created was a very horrible person, and with no manners and filthy and no support, no guidance, no positive energy, you know, just going through her day and trying to figure out how to dodge the next touch or the next fit or the next sexual night of being held down captive, you know, with this hand covering my mouth. So I didn't know that I don't know, and I guess it was after, whenever I finally got back into school, which is whenever I was 25 and I was pregnant with my third baby, and I knew after already having been divorced from their dad and then getting back together and remarrying so that I could try very hard to keep my family together and provide for them, because I knew I couldn't provide for the kids on my own. And I knew I had to get back into school. And it was going through school being empowered by those teachers and seeing how my brain actually worked, being up at 3 o'clock in the morning working on my word processing and my keyboarding and my office administrative and my accounting, and going through this every day, you know, and having one inside me, you know, and two little ones to take care of. But I did it, and I graduated valedictorian, and I got to give the valedictorian speech.
Wow.
And that to me, yeah. I mean, that to me, considering that I dropped out of school at 16, and I was nothing more, you know, I was a bartender, I was a waitress, my relationships were hell, I was almost killed I don't know how many times.
Daily.
So, you know, this, to me, was powerful. This said to me, you know what, Trish? You can. You're going to be okay, because now you've got the education that you can get the job, that you don't have to worry. And I was at least, you know, I mean, our life wasn't perfect. The only bad part was that I wasn't good by myself, because whenever I was by myself, my thoughts ran too much.
Right.
So I was always seeking for someone to love me. And, you know, it's not that I ran, you know, from boyfriend to boyfriend to boyfriend. It wasn't that kind. I mean, I was with my first husband for 8 years. I was with my second husband for almost 9 years. You know, so I made in these continuous long-term relationships, but they just so happened to be the long relationships. You know, but it, having that education and knowing that whenever I left there that night and moving forward, I knew that everything was going to be okay. And
wow.
It just grew from there. That was the best thing for me, was to get that education and graduate valedictorian when I didn't think that I could do. I mean, I failed most of my classes in school, but that was because I had everything at home to deal with, you know.
Right.
And I never
knew.
No one could
deal with what you had to deal with and school and all those things. That was
you still got to be a kid and you still got to go to school every day. That's what I feel so horrible about these kids, these poor babies. You know, they have to deal with this and the strength that they show. You know, the opening song that you use, Deep Dark Secret, is such a powerful statement of what these children express each and every day. To get up and move through school and not say anything to anyone, but know that they will more than likely be raped or beaten when they get home.
Right.
And, you know, and they got to face this and deal with this every day, day in and day out. So, you know, that song is so powerful to me, and I think that it expresses so dearly what it is that these, you know, what all survivors trying to put their life back together are going through. You know, because we do get so lost in it. It just absorbs every part of it. So I think that's where my life changed.
Yeah. And Annie, what about you? How did you keep your spirit through all that? Because your father was brutal.
Yeah, I'm actually struck by a lot of what Tricia says. I was failing in school, and you're right. You know, you got more important things to think about than history and math, and you're just trying to survive day by day. I mean, you're kind of like born to it. I just went through so many of the same experiences she did, and I think most survivors, to one extent or another, they all go through the same kinds of things. Would you mind if I just read this paragraph to you? Because it kind of sums up exactly how I feel about it.
Well, please do.
Since I was once just a little girl and fragile, I was my parents' incomplete thought in the back seat of a car at conception and the creature that would go on to ruin their lives. I was without substance, courage, appreciation, or understanding. I believed I was treated so badly because I was so very wicked. I was self-serving and cared only for my own survival. I would not risk extra whippings or death to save my younger brothers. I believed I was undeserving and worthless character whom my parents did not want and who God disapproved of. As I got older, I was just as certain I would live, grow, and leave my hell. If I could endure to escape that household, I would do something that mattered. I would make my life matter somehow. For our lives to matter, even if it's only in some small way, isn't that what we all want?
Wow. How
beautiful. Oh, perfect. Perfect. Man.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, you ladies, y'all are just so strong. And the thing that you went through, all that you did at such little ages, I look at my grandchild now and I think about y'all's stories and I can't even imagine the survival skills necessary to do that every day. And I hope she never has to endure anything like that. And you can bet I'm watching everybody that comes around her.
Well, I was just thinking, no, if that's your grandbaby, nobody's going to hurt it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you do all you can, because I'm a survivor as well, and you do all you can to break the cycle and to build a foundation for your child. But I had to learn and come out of things a lot like you ladies did. So by the time I learned it, she was already 12, 13 years old, you know. And then you have them try to reteach them, and they're not listening at that point because they're teenagers and they know all the answers. Meanwhile, right. You're like, everything I told you up to this point is wrong. You might want to pay attention to what I'm saying
again.
Now.
Clear the chalkboard. We're going to start all over again.
God, that's true. I gave you all that bad advice. Let me give you some different advice.
You know when I said I knew what I was talking about? I was wrong. So I really need you to listen. Then you watch your grandchildren be born, and you watch the fact of what they had to live and the choices that your child makes as for a mate, and then you end up going like, now we got to start another cycle that I have to fight because now she chose somebody who isn't in the child's life or whatever reason, and now you're fighting for your grandchild's survival and protection. So it's a constant battle when you have something of this level of abuse of trying to just protect each generation.
And in that video,
I'd like to briefly mention something. I think it was Annie. Yeah, I think you're the one who mentioned about the dangers of little ones being sexually assaulted at home. And,
oh yeah.
One of my major dangers was getting the shit beaten out of me every day. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I remember when I was a little guy, and I'm still pretty little, well, maybe I got a big head, but I remember times when, you know, my dad was a professional photographer, and he worked in a studio, and he did a number of jobs here and there. Every time he came home, I found myself, and lo and behold, here's my sister Tricia and my sister Annie again, and I'm sure many others. As soon as I heard that door open, I would hide.
Mm-hmm.
I would hide. And one day, he walks in, and I'm kind of huddled against the corner and hoping that I'm invisible to him. And lo and behold, he sees me.
Mm.
And the first thought that crosses my mind is, he's going to tell me, what are you doing standing there? What is the matter with you? And then beat the crap out of me. All he did was smile. And I thought I was going to pass out. Now, the good thing about me is that, you see, when I was a kid, I also landed head first on concrete. So there was not much damage he could do there. But the one point where I grabbed onto my power, but it backfired on my ass for many, 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 many years. And I have to be honest about this because Nell and I have had conversations about what history lies behind many people who perpetrate these crimes. And one day, and I was already married, I was a married man, and I don't think my eldest daughter was even born yet. You know, we were staying with my parents because I was having trouble finding work, and my father decided to get on my ass about something, and I was upstairs in my old room, and he and my wife, my then wife, she's my ex-wife now, for reasons I will not go into. Essentially, I married my father. You know, she goes upstairs, she says, "Oh, honey, your father's really upset that you're up here alone and not downstairs with the rest of the family." And I walked downstairs and I crossed my arms and sat across from him, and he made his comment. So when I answered back, he said, "You want to take it outside?" That's where I claimed it. That's when I lost it, and I said, I got up, and I began to hit myself in the head. And I said, "You," with each punch, "you can't hurt me. Let's go outside and finish it now." And he never, ever challenged me or perpetrated anything against me again. But it backfired on me. And this is a question, this is going to segue into a question for you, my sisters. I thought, and I was a young man, maybe about 21, so that's, we're talking 30 years ago. My temper followed me through the years. And I found myself repeating a vicious cycle that was perpetrated against me until I was able to connect to the sacred, and I was able to calm it down. But, you know, was there, and I'm sure there was, because I remember you reading in the beginning, Annie. It really got to me. Are you ready? Are you talking your have you talked yourself out of hell?
Right.
You know, and I'm sure that there was anger. How did you sisters deal with the anger? I dealt with it wrong for many years and had to learn. You know, how did you girls handle it? Because doggone it, man,
what?
It still haunts me.
I didn't know that I was angry. I didn't know that I was depressed. And
yeah.
I didn't, you know, you, boy, I'm not sure I can spit this out. You can be, when you get so angry and you have a lifetime of that is just not allowed, you turn it inward. It turns inside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't depressed like go in there, eat a pound of pasta and sleep all the time. I was depressed and I couldn't sleep and I couldn't sit still. I was very agitated all the time. But
wow.
You're just fighting those feelings. When I was in the hospital, I spent a lot of time, because we called it the paddle room. And it was just a room with a bat and a big giant pillow that you'd just go in there and you would just beat. And I
wow.
was in there a couple times a day.
Mm-hmm.
That you got to
well,
get rid of that anger
yeah.
somehow.
Well, you know, you make a good point, because part of my habit, I was an armed security officer with peace officer status. So what I used to do is I used to leave my gun home, and I would go to a bar. And that was my pillow hugging. Because I would drink, and I didn't like alcohol. I didn't like the taste of it. But what I was intending to do, and I think that there were a lot of people out there who could relate to this. And you know, I was very self-destructive, and my intention on getting drunk was that so I could not defend myself. And I found myself self-destructing in that manner. So I can relate to that.
That's interesting.
I hated myself. You know, it was really awful.
I used to, by the time I was 21 or 22, I would spend a lot of time in the bars drinking. And I discovered that it was very powerful to play with men. It was a very dangerous thing to do. But I would go into the bars and, you know, pick a half a dozen guys out and just pretend I was going to take them home and watch how they behaved. And that was very powerful to me to suddenly find out, well, I could be in charge of this guy. And
wow.
One of the first things my therapist did was make me sign a contract. I wouldn't go to a bar for a year.
That might be a good thing there.
I wish I had signed a contract like that. Mine was going to a bar and picking a fight with the biggest dude there.
Yeah, I wasn't much of a fight picker, but there was a lot of power in being female and 22 years old.
Yeah,
oh, yeah,
well, there's a lot of power in the female, that's for sure.
And but, you know, it can be very destructive.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And yeah, and not for 1 minute did I ever entertain the idea that any of those men were interested in me because I was a nice person.
Right.
It was because I played with them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I want to do is, because these issues are so complex, I want to actually do two or three different shows in addition to this one where we continue talking about it, because there's so many different aspects to this that you really can't just fit it all into one
no.
show.
No.
It runs so
well,
deep,
I imagine,
you know.
I'm sorry,
go ahead, Annie.
Patricia, I didn't hear you.
Oh, no, I, you know, David had brought up the issues of what we do with our anger. And, Annie, I was so much like you. You know, during my 20s, I was focused on my children. But after their father ran off with them, and I really, really went absolutely insane, and to me, that was my power as well. I would go into the bar because going into the bar and drinking, I could wash away all of the low self-esteem, and I could build it up with all this alcohol. It makes you feel stronger. It makes you feel powerful. You're not ashamed of yourself. It wipes all of that away.
It makes you big.
Yeah, it makes you big. You know, beer muscles.
I think these are such important conversations because this really puts a light on. It just doesn't go away because you're not that little kid at home anymore.
No, it's
so many people are, you know, well, it's over, get over it. It takes years to, you actually were born the day you left home.
That's
exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They say in that kind of stuff, your emotional development is put on hold during that time. So you actually have to go back and finish growing up first before you can begin your adult life. Even though you may be 25, 30 years old, mentally, you stop growing.
Good point.
And that's without the patience of someone saying, oh, you know, you're just 8 years old. You just don't understand. You're 30.
Right.
You should get it. What's the matter with you?
Well,
I understand a lot now at the age of 25.
Yeah,
me too.
You know, it's amazing what kind of knowledge comes with age and how we see things pass forward in the cycle. You know, and like now we're talking about, you know, you see your kids making the same decisions because of how your life and your choices that were all screwed up from the abuse you went through. Now your children have lived this, they're reflected in this, their decisions, their choices are now being passed on to their children. So
right, and it's more painful to watch my grandchild suffer because I know more. It rips my heart out to watch anything happen to her, because I know
so much more.
You
can do. Yeah, you have no power.
It's like you know more, but you have no power, and it's like, oh, thank you for that. One thing I did want to ask. I know my father was a very angry man, and what it did was it taught me how to be very aware of what a person's mood was when they came in the room within a second, because that's what it required to survive. And so I want to know, out of everything you faced, what are the skills that you use that actually work to your advantage? Like, I can look at a person's face and tell instantly if they're in a good, bad mood, whatever, because that's what I had to learn as a kid. What did y'all learn that has helped you throughout life?
That is a biggie. That is exactly picking up on those little sensors of how to check on, you know, what you may be doing wrong that is going to set them off and make them hurt you.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, there was a article that Jennifer Bowen did in our local newspaper whenever she did this big article about the book, whenever My Justice was released, and they came over and they did an interview. And she used one of my deep and intense words is, you know, for 32 years I was afraid to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're afraid that, you know, no matter what you do, something's going to set them off, no matter how hard you try not to. But I think as we go through this, you do pick up on, you know, the issues with me, I guess, with the repeated attacks that were, you know, just, I mean, seriously, almost deadly, you know, drowning and choking and weapons and, you know, all of this, I just literally felt that if I did anything at all, I was going to screw something up. So I think the biggest thing for me was just just learning how to avoid, and I became perfectionist at everything. Everything I did became perfection. My kids were spotless. My house was spotless. The meals were excellent, on time. Nothing was out of place. The yard work was done. I took the responsibility of doing absolutely everything, including, you know, making sure that my second husband, it became a requirement that he leave work every morning at 4:30 in the morning. I'm glad this is a mature show. He couldn't leave the house without a blowjob. That's what I did. I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I fixed him a ham and egg sandwich to take to work, made his lunch, which was usually supper the night before because he'd, you know, come home drunk and pass out or beat me or whatever. But usually it was packing up his supper from the night before, making his breakfast sandwich, and go in to wake him up with a blowjob so that he can go ahead and get up and get ready to go to work. And if I didn't do the work just in that manner, then I knew the night was going to be hell.
Right.
So I was that sensitive about how people reacted to what I did. That
oh, yeah.
That was my big thing. That was my big thing.
What about you, Annie?
Oh, man. Did the same thing. I did the same thing.
Isn't it funny? I mean, we just
yeah.
learn these, you know. You just
you know,
so
you're
yeah.
You
just,
right,
you just, and I consciously tried to read his mind. Because
yeah.
My dad would like cycle. It was almost like he was manic. He would kind of
manic.
Cycle through these emotions just throughout the day, and you'd always anything could set him off. He never knew what it was going to be, and I would consciously try to read him, and I do read people fairly well. Matter of fact, I was a drug and alcohol counselor for guys coming out of prison for a little while. And I was really good at it, but it was because I could read them. They they acted in a familiar way. I wasn't, these were dangerous
men.
They really were dangerous men. And I wasn't
yeah.
afraid of them because I understood them.
Yeah.
On like a cellular level. You know.
They were familiar to you.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I don't know. You could probably line up 50 of us. We'd all tell you the same story.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
yeah, I think that's the biggest thing is that how we learn to read people.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. I definitely had to learn it because you never knew what would set him off. So,
you know, that's constantly watching somebody to see what's going to do it.
It just, I hate all that.
No. You are so untruthful, because this
what?
Woman, this woman could read me from almost 1,000 miles. That's my hell.
I can. I'm really.
Hey, what's up with you? What's up with
that
you?
Is,
nothing.
That is a true spiritual connection there. That is a true
yeah,
spiritual connection.
Oh, yeah.
You know what the funny thing is, though? We all tried so hard to read people, and we got so good at it, and we utterly failed where we learned
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
You would think we wouldn't take that with us.
Right.
You would think, but, you know, we do. I think it goes back to that, you know, very beginning whenever Nell said, you know, your children live what you teach them.
Right.
Right.
We were programmed. We were not raised. We were not supported. We were not guided. We were programmed.
Right.
To this was your world. You didn't step out of bounds. You stayed within their control because you had no other choice. This was your world.
Right.
Everything else was on the outside, and it didn't matter. You weren't allowed to reach out. You weren't allowed to speak out. You weren't allowed to object. You know, we come from the generation when speaking against your parents was of utmost disrespect. And
yeah.
You didn't speak against family. You didn't air your dirty laundry. You didn't do any of that. It was just generational. This is what was, period, end of story. And I think on top of that, it made that program, because I know I was programmed with all that I had the responsibility of doing. You know, by the time I was 11 years old, I was a functioning housewife.
Me too.
You know, mother, caregiver, laundry taker, and cook, and, you know, just everything else. We weren't raised. We were just programmed, and we lived that life according to that program, because it took breaking down before we could actually open up and start reprogramming again. We had to break down.
Wow. Before we get too deep in, I want you ladies to tell us the name of your book and websites or any contact information, because we have about 23 minutes left. The song at the end is a little over 6 minutes, so we don't have a lot longer. So, Patricia, would you tell us about your book and how to contact you and all that?
Oh, I'd love to. the book was published through Off Publishing. You can go to Author House. /bookstore and find it there. It's available in ebook and paperback. You can find it on Amazon in Kindle and paperback, and Barnes and Noble in the Nook and paperback. It's really, you Google My Justice and it will come up. And I've been blessed. I have to thank Mr. Peter Thomas Sinise. Is a wonderful author, and he works with, he's building the Eye Care Foundation to protect against international parental abductions. And he actually purchased my book and gave me an awesome review, and then backed it up with two major press releases. So if anybody types in My Justice, you're going to find all the information from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kindle, Nook, Author House. I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/TrishaGirl62. I've also got a support group for women survivors, both child abuse and domestic violence. And it's a private online group. It's very secret. It's a small little comfort family that if anybody needs some support, some positive energy on a daily basis, it's just a place to check in with other women. So connect with me. We'll talk. We'll get you in the group. I've also got a blog out there called SurvivorsJustice.com. And you can share all the information on the blog. And plus, I'm with the Dreamcatchers for Abused Children. They're executive director for their blog talk program. And I'm on the air with them right now at 5 nights a week. So, and everything child abuse. So anybody that wants, I'm on Twitter, TrishaGirl62. Anybody can find me out there. Just connect with me. I love connecting with other survivors.
Absolutely. Annie.
Okay, next, Annie.
Well, that's a tough act to follow.
No. You're my hero, girl. Are you kidding me?
Well, I'm really happy to say my third book, I just did the final edit of the final edit of the final edit. You can't believe how many final edits I did. When it's going out to paper book, Patricia probably already knows this, but they want everything absolutely perfect, and it's been a real job. But all three books are going to be under one cover. It'll be out the date that we're trying, and it looks like we're ahead of schedule, is April 9th. You'll be able to pick that up in paperback without any artwork, or you'll be able to buy it online, pretty much how it's been available. with all color art, if you want to download it, all the survivor art and stuff that I did when I was in therapy. The book has all sorts of resources in the back. So I'm very excited about that. I have, I'm on Facebook, I'm Twitter, I'm pretty much everywhere that Patricia just mentioned. If you Google "Can You Hear Me Now" by Annie O'Sullivan, it comes up all over Amazon, Barnes and Noble, any place that you like to buy books, you can get it.
Sweet.
And I'm on Facebook as well. So
perfect.
Wow.
Before
anything, there are a couple of other places I'd like to throw out there to our listeners. People for Hope with Matt Viana. People for Hope. Matt Viana is on Facebook also. People for Hope is on Facebook. And also my awesome brother, Michael Boucher, You Are Not Alone Foundation. The You Are Not Alone Foundation. For those of you going through depression and suicide and suicidal ideations or tendencies, these are also resources that you can go to, if you need help, because you are not alone. So thank you.
Perfect.
May I interject something real quick here?
I'm sorry.
No, you read my book, and at the end of the book goes in stages, child, woman, survivor. At the end of the book, I wanted to make sure that I was touching the hearts of everyone that was reading this. So the best thing that got me through was the positive affirmations that my trauma therapist had given me that I carried with me and read daily. So the very last page of the book, of my justice, I wrote down some positive affirmations that I'd like to share real quick with the survivors, everyone that's listening out there.
Okay.
So some positive thoughts about you. You deserve a safe place to sleep. You deserve respect. You deserve kindness and support. You deserve as much love as you freely give to others.
Mm.
You deserve roses in your garden of life. And everybody deserves those things. These are rights that are given to us as human beings. The right to be safe, the right to be loved. And it's so important that everybody remember that they have these rights. They are human. They have these rights.
Lila Waste.
Beautiful. I think we're going to close the show now. And does anybody have anything else to say before we close?
No, I'm good. It's just awesome. I think that this whole idea of bringing this together and touching on all of these subjects and carrying the show forward and talking and making it real for everybody out there is really, this is so needed, and I respect you, and I love you, and I think that you are just absolutely awesome, you and David both, to put this together.
For everybody to dig out of what was created for them and just try to have as much quality of life as they can without being haunted or anything else. I want them to be the beautiful spirits they would have been if the world would have left them alone and let them grow up.
Well, I know that I personally, on this show today, have dealt with three of the most beautiful spirits I've ever met. And I love you. I love you, ladies, so, so much. You are my family. I appreciate you. And to all listening, I want to thank everybody for listening in. I know that the lovely Pat Lee Heath out there listening. And I know that there are other listeners out there. I thank you for being with us on Fire Talk today. I was your host for this show with my co-host, my beautiful, wonderful co-host, Nell Cole, and our wonderful, wonderful sisters, Patricia McKnight and Annie O'Sullivan. Thank you. Be good to one another. And remember, you are not alone.
Absolutely.
Love and peace, my family. Thank you very, very much.
Uh-huh.
Thanks for having us.
And more to come.
Yes,
all right,
more to come.
Yeah, I'm going to play Michael Buscher, You Are Not Alone.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Won't stop. You're not to blame. together.